Please be seated. This is Slavak versus Cole, 65428. Ms. March, if you're ready to begin, and if you wish to reserve any time, that is the first time you wish to reserve.
Yes, I told the clerk I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Marie March. May it please the court, and I represent the appellants James Slavak, Nathan Emerson, and Tucson Sargon. This is a pretty straightforward appeal on a motion to dismiss that was sua sponte turned into a motion for summary judgment without notice. And the district court judge said because there were documents attached to the complaint and to the motion to dismiss that you should know it's converted to a motion for summary judgment. However, the documents that were attached to the First Amendment complaint were part of the complaint. As you know, anything, these were the contracts, they become part of the complaint. And in the motion to dismiss, the documents that were attached were a copy of the First Amendment complaint, a request for judicial notice of the underlying motion that appointed the receiver, and I believe it might have been something else with judicial notice. And those are also not considered outside of pleading. The judge in her order said that when she converted it to a motion for summary judgment, and it's quoted in my brief gets kind of repetitive as I was reading it, and I apologize, I kind of just kept saying the same thing, but she said, well, there's documents attached, 49 pages, and she considered the affidavits and the documents attached. Well, there were no affidavits attached, and the 49-page document that were attached to the motion to dismiss were, again, not evidence. It was a First Amendment complaint and documents which asked for judicial notice. Nonetheless, she, at the hearing on the motion to dismiss, sua sponte converted it to a motion for summary judgment. There was no notice given. It's required at least to get 10 days notice, as you know, under Rule 56C. There was none, and I personally wasn't at the motion to dismiss, but other counsel for the plaintiffs, Mr. Martinson, was. And was quite surprised when she converted it, and then he said, well, at least can we get discovery under Rule 56F, which under motion for summary judgment, as you know, you're allowed to do that.
We understand that argument for the most part. What we are really concerned with is your position as to whether or not Mr. Corey should be entitled to absolute immunity as a court-appointed receiver. And whether that is something that changes the outcome in this particular matter or does not change the outcome in your position.
I do not believe he's entitled to absolute immunity because he'd be entitled to it if he acts within the scope of the order that's appointing him. And in this case, he didn't do anything. And I couldn't find a case that just says if a receiver does nothing, but I believe that by doing nothing, that's outside of the scope. The order specifically said, you take control of these specific bank accounts, and those are the bank accounts that my clients wired the money into, and Mr. Corey, during a hearing in the related case as a receiver, he testified he never changed his signature on the account. He didn't look at the bank statements. He basically didn't do anything because he didn't think there was anything to do, I guess. But the order had restricted the amount of money that Mr. Carmen would take out to $25,000. That's per month, if I'm not mistaken. But he went way over that. He took out $2 million and gave them the casinos, and it was all lost. So I believe that doing nothing, that is outside of the scope because he did nothing, and he should be personally responsible for that, and the immunity would not apply to that.
And we understand your argument. I guess our question is authority to back up that real argument you're making. Now, we have this case in Ames versus Quorum Partnership, 113 Nevada 195, which I know Mr. Corey's counsel responded saying he has absolute immunity under that case. I think the response was, well, he didn't do things perfectly or didn't handle the things the way you felt that we should have, so therefore he shouldn't have immunity. But do you have any legal authority to back that up?
In Ames, it said it is, you get an absolute immunity, and but that's for following within the scope. Like I said, I couldn't find authority right on point by a receiver that does absolutely nothing. And I believe by doing absolutely nothing, when the court orders him to do that, by not doing that, that's not within the scope of the order. It was very specific what he was supposed to do, very specific the bank accounts he was supposed to take.
Well, could you think if judges get cases, let's say a judge is running this receivership and the judge didn't enter timely orders, good things maybe the judge could have been more diligent about, could you sue the judge for not handling the case correctly using that same analysis?
I don't believe so. I think
that's what's the difference? Because the judge is a judicial officer, and the receiver is appointed by a court order. The receiver is now a court officer through appointment by court order. So how would you distinguish the two?
Well, I think in this case it is distinguished, again, because he did nothing, but he went and told a third party that he shit his pants and shit himself if he didn't know, if he knew the money that was taken out. He knew what was going on and that it was wrong, and yet he did nothing to protect the money. And I do think that's distinguishable when the judge that the judge says, why would you do something or whatnot? That's just judicial immunity. But in the hearing on in the other case, the related cases, the receivership, the receiver didn't do any receiver reports, didn't do any accounting. He didn't do anything. And I cannot believe by not doing anything, this isn't being slow, getting it done late, or whatnot, by not doing anything, that could apply to absolute immunity. And again, in the complaint, everything has to be accepted as true for those purposes, where it is alleged that he acted without outside of the scope. And I believe that we never got to the motion to dismiss because it jumped forward to a motion for summary judgment. I believe that whether he acted within the scope is a factual question, and I did have some authority in mind if you wanted me to look for it. That even if we got to the summary judgment stage, I believe at the dismissal that I could have amended it. It wouldn't have been futile. I could have amended it to make it more specific. He asked for a more definite statement. And I agree, I could have done that.
My concern is, and I understand your argument about the summary judgment and the timeliness of it, but if the subject matter was appropriate for a motion to dismiss, that is whether or not he had absolute immunity as his appointment as a receiver, even if the judge erred in converting it to a motion for summary judgment, the judge could have dismissed the case as a motion to dismiss because it's like a statute of limitations type defense. You know, this isn't a basis to proceed on that unless you come up with some legally recognizable tort, which I'm not sure what it would be, you know, a directed towards a receiver.
Well,
my point is, you know, maybe it was error, but maybe is it harmless because the judge could have still treated it as a motion to dismiss.
No, because in the complaint, it alleges that he acted outside of the scope of the immunity. It's alleged that. So for that purpose, at that stage in the proceeding, that had to be accepted as true. And if later on...
What if you allege the judge acts outside his scope of authority, how he processes the case, hasn't done it proper, hasn't followed the court rules, delays, whatever, does that open the door to suing the judge? I'm kind of going back to that original analogy I drew to the receivership appointment.
I honestly say, I guess it would depend on what it is, if it's such an egregious thing that I don't know.
Let's say a judge, for whatever reason, just isn't on top of his or her calendar, it's delayed. There's prejudice to the litigants because of this delay, and the judge really isn't on top of his or her work, and that results in damages to litigants. Could the litigants sue the judge for not processing the case properly? Is there any, that's kind of an analogy I was thinking in this case, if there would be a basis to do that.
For a judge that delays, I agree there's absolute immunity, but this case is different. It wasn't delay. It's not doing what he was ordered to do by the court.
I understand.
Okay.
The concern, Judge, to be straightforward, the concern we have, it's a matter of whether we're talking about qualified immunity or absolute immunity. And from our case law, we seem to be moving with a receiver appointed by the court more so to absolute immunity than qualified immunity. If we're on the qualified immunity, part of your position as to doing the job and not doing the job kind of comes into play. But as to absolute immunity, kind of the gloves are off. What's your position as to that?
I believe qualified immunity would apply here. And that would be, factual, that would go on past the complaint. I believe you have qualified immunity, and if the evidence came out that he stayed within the constrictions of what he was ordered to do, qualified immunity, he would be immune still under that. I'm not saying he's not immune at all, but it would be qualified immunity because he just has, he has reckless disregard of just this, he's ordered for something, okay, to go to your mind. If you get an order from him, you guys are the Supreme Court. So if you, if the Supreme Court ordered a district court judge to do something,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't do it, I would think there would be some kind of a remedy there.
Well, there is judicial discipline. I mean, there are remedies,
but that's not quite
the point. It doesn't really affect the litigants, though,
right,
like that.
Right.
Let me ask you one other question because I don't want to take up all your time and,
okay.
and all. And I'll ask Mr. Schaefer the same thing. We had a recent Nevada Supreme Court case called Harrison versus Wakeman. It's decided at 131 Nevada Advance Opinion number 92. So it's very recent. I don't know if either one of you even had a chance to read it because it's kind of hot off the press. But if you haven't read it, it basically says that an expert witness retained in a case is given absolute immunity from suit over what the expert witness reports to the court and all like that. So it's not a court-appointed officer or a receiver, it's an expert witness, but potentially that could, I just wonder if you think that case would have any impact on this one at all or if it's not relevant.
No, I haven't seen the case. And I've looked at cases before I came here. I haven't seen that case. But I think, even for a receiver, they're doing what they're doing. And if they make a bad business decision, they sell off stuff or whatever, they're still new because they're doing it within their business sense or whatever. So an expert witness doing a report is doing it within their business sense, for lack of a better description. So if they do it wrong or whatever, they still have immunity. But I still believe by doing nothing when he's ordered to specifically do these things, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, he does nothing, he admits he did nothing. If you just look at the bank statements, you see the wires coming in, I mean, at least would notice it. So I've got 2 minutes left, so I'm going to say.
We'll give you 4 or 3 minutes on the button.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. On behalf of Mr. Coy, Mr. Schaefer.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Chief Schaefer. I'm with Mr. Coy. Mr. Coy is in the courtroom today. We're here because to address the issue of whether a court-appointed receiver acting solely within their capacity as a receiver enjoys immunity or whether they have liability to a third party for personal business affairs of the principal of the company for which he's been appointed as a receiver. Mm-hmm. I think the clear answer under the Barton Doctrine is that he does enjoy immunity. The remedy that is available to any potential parties is that to seek leave of the court appointing them as a receiver and seeking some sort of injunction or review by that appointing court of their actions. That is the remedy that is available to the parties. That remedy was available to Mr. Slezak and the other appellants in this action. They chose not to avail themselves of that option.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Chairman. Mrs. Mersch is arguing that the immunity should be qualified versus absolute. What's your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are based upon some other jurisdictions that have ruled on this issue as to whether or not a party acted appropriately when it's argued that they are acting within their scope and may have not done what they were supposed to, everything they were supposed to do, or may have made a bad business call. The great point of the authority on that is that there is an immunity, that you examine immunity first and not whether or not their actions were reasonable, because to do so essentially moots the question of immunity. It puts the cart before
the horse. Is it absolute or qualified then?
Well, I think that it is absolute to the extent that they are acting, well, it is qualified subject to the review of the issuing court. So
okay, well, qualified is a lesser standard, and it might open the door to this type of case is potential. I don't know. It might. Absolute would be a complete bar. So I'm just saying, from what you understand of the law, do you see any wiggle room in the type of immunity, or does it have to be absolute?
To a receiver acting within the scope of their authority, I believe that it is absolute. When they are acting outside their authority, both Ames and subsequent cases have indicated that there is a remedy available to a party to bring a claim against a receiver acting outside the scope of their authority.
That's a concern, because if we looked at it as qualified, then we would be in a situation where we are looking at the fact that this was ruled upon as a summary judgment without notice. It might force us to send this back. If it is an absolute immunity case, then we can say the district court erred, but it was harmless. Would you like to speak to those issues?
I would, Your Honor. I'll take first both. I think the reaffirm that it is immune. It is an absolute immunity. They are a categorical employee or agent or officer of the court acting within their authority. As for the notice issue, I don't believe that there wasn't an issue of lack of notice here, both of the motion. Any motion brought in 12b-5 has the potential to be converted to a motion for summary judgment. In fact, the case I've read from this court has indicated that a motion in which the judge has...
It can be converted, but it calls for actual notice prior to that hearing.
And the fact of it is that appellants were aware of the conversion. In fact, in the opposition to the motion to dismiss, argued that defendants were trying to convert this from a motion for summary judgment. That was filed on February 11th of 2011, prior to the motion. So they were not just on constructive notice that there was the possibility, they were on actual notice, also the fact that additional pleadings were submitted. Further notice was heard subsequently. They were certainly on the notice on the motion for reconsideration that there was a motion for summary judgment being decided at that point. And I think that they have met the notice requirements. At no point, they've raised the issue of 56F, that's not applicable here, because they didn't meet the demand that's required. They didn't submit it under affidavit that set out the discovery that they needed or what facts they would anticipate showing. But even if they did that, the fact that there is a absolute immunity for Mr. Corey's actions acting as a receiver would be a bar. The only way there would not be a bar is if there was some sort of independent agreement or arrangement between Mr. Corey and Mr. Slezak and the other appellants in this action, which there's no allegation that that was the case. The sole responsibility or sole liability they're alleging is that Mr. Corey, acting as receiver, as an officer of the court, did not do what he said he was supposed to do. Contrary to appellant's allegations, Mr. Corey was very active in the case, just not active as to this third party, who he had no notice of, no claims with, no reason to be aware of at the time. Based upon those allegations, there's really no basis for them to assert that there was any basis for negligence, because they can't establish a duty, and that's what the court found. Both under the absolute immunity under Barton Doctrine, and also the absolute lack of any evidence, affidavit, or other supporting allegations that would leave no basis to lead to a genuine question of material fact, to the establishment of any duty or relationship between Mr. Corey and Mr. Slezak and the other appellants, was the basis on which the court issued their summary judgment. And on that basis, there's really no basis going further. The other elements that they have here, because the principles of the Barton Doctrine are essentially that the receiver is acting as the agent for the court. In current construction court, which we said in our brief, courts have held that upholding immunity for receivers is important because denying immunity would cause the receiver to be a lightning rod for harassing litigation aimed at judicial orders. It would cause a collateral attack upon the orders of the court. In fact, if you go back to the original case of this, the Barton Doctrine 1881 case, the court in that case expressed a concern that if a collateral action was allowed, that other creditors may seek another action to try and bypass the orderly administration of the company or of the receiver, try to jump the line, as it were, to make their claim against the company. And that's a real practical concern, not only the fact that they are acting as an absolutely immune agent or officer of the court, but also the fact that the administration of justice requires consolidated action. That was permissible, that was available in this case. Because that was not pursued, there is no basis for that. It's important that the court address the issue of the bottom rock and reaffirm it, because the court has the care, the receiver is essentially only a creature or officer of the court. And if the receiver's actions are criticized, and the court itself's actions are criticized, and the court is not subject to action, to some suit, based upon some sort of delay. The available remedies to them are writ actions to the appellate, or writs through the appellate procedure, or judicial discipline or some other action. Not independent personal liability for action performed in the course of their duties. The clear line of authority is that there is no exception. Although appellant cited to a statutory exception, which is a very minor one, is available in federal court, that's not available here. Further, even in those courses, all those cases, when a bankruptcy trustee's actions are being challenged, leave is required to be sought of the bankruptcy trustee.
So the bankruptcy trustees, do they have absolute immunity for their, under federal law, for their actions?
I believe that they do, except under narrow sets of circumstances which are waived by 28 U.S.C. 592A. And that is a very narrow set of circumstances. And that's really, there's a line of authority, but certainly the cases that have followed that inaction, well, the very existence of the statute, undermines the existence of the Garden Doctrine, because it requires, he makes the exception to it and provides for a narrow circumstance. Second, the cases that follow that, Maria Castillo and others that were cited in this case, reaffirm that leave of court is required from each new venue. I think that we hear the issue of venue is also one that was not appropriately addressed. And the court in that case addressed the issue of venue indirectly, in that they did not hold that because the case, the secondary case filed by the receiver was in the same district of the 8th Judicial District Court, that leave was not, did not need to be brought. Rather, they saw that, so that leave was not needed because of, they were exceeding their authority. Implicit in that argument is the fact that leave needs to be sought at the issuing officer or the issuing department, as it was here, to proceed with an action against the receiver. Because of that, that itself is a bar. They moved to the bar of the absolute immunity, moved to the bar of the fact that they did not establish a genuine issue of material fact as to the issue of negligence or any of the other causes of action alleged in the complaint. If there is no, just because the receiver was appointed does not mean that they have liability to every party in the entire universe, every potential claim. It's only as to the parties which were part of that action, which is another reason why leave needs to be brought before that court so that it can be a consolidated administration of justice. Here, Mr. Corey was not aware of these independent claims or loans that were issued by Mr. Conlon to Mr. Suzak and the other appellants. There is no tie to Global Edge Trading, the company for which Mr. Corey was appointed as receiver. The documents themselves indicate that they are loans personally made. The affidavit of Mr. Conlon submitted in the bankruptcy court under penalty of perjury lists them as individual secured creditors. They were secured by shares that he had, but there was no conversion. They had no part of Global Edge. There's no indication that the monies were used for the benefit of Global Edge. There's no obligation on the part of Global Edge to repay this, and therefore no obligation on the part of Mr. Corey to ensure repayment or preserve those funds. These were Mr. Conlon's funds. Mr. Conlon had the money. Mr. Conlon is obligated. Mr. Corey is not. As to the issue, I think we've addressed the issue of notice that they were appropriately, that there was sufficient notice of the possibility and the actual existence of both the notice of the motion to dismiss and the possibility that it would be converted, and that based upon that, the notice does not change the fact that the court ruled upon the evidence that was presented to it, and plaintiffs or appellants had an opportunity to address this sufficiently. As per the rule in Eden Ventures and in Choi v. North Star, Rule 56 is not available. But I think it's very important that the court, I think the court is aware of the existence of the nature of why the bond doctrine is so important. The great weight of case law establishes, and we cited a lead to capital tariffs, and out of the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, and Washington v. Foster, which says that no liability can exist if the receiver as a ministerial neutral officer of the appointing court, because their authority is derived solely from the act of the court. There's going to be winners and losers. Just because there was a loser does not mean that that loser has a right of action against the receiver, if that receiver was acting in the authority that they have. The court has any further questions I'd ask and entertain them at this time. Any
issue? Nothing issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll try to be very brief. Counsel started by saying that there was notice, and he referred to the notices in the motion to reconsider. That's not notice that the court was converting the motion to dismiss into a motion for summary judgment. There was absolutely no notice of that. And then counsel said, well, as far as asking for discovery under Rule 56F, in the opposition to the motion to dismiss in the record at page 77, I said if the court was inclined to treat it as a motion to dismiss, I'd seek leave to do discovery consider it as a motion for summary judgment. I'd seek leave to do discovery and respond to it as a motion for summary judgment. The issue of the collateral attack, that was never raised in the court below. I don't think it can be raised here. That was never brought up below, as I can remember. The exceptions to the Barton Doctrine, there is a statute, 28 U.S.C. 959A. Justice asked, where is their authority? Where we go outside of absolute immunity? Well, there is a statute that says that a receiver can be sued, be personally liable, if they were without scope. That's also in the Hans case, that there could be personal liability if they go outside of the scope. So I do believe that the authority supports that. And as far as the duty to my clients, there are exhibits in there where you show the bank statements and when they come in. And under 26 U.S. 959A, the receivers and managers of any property may be sued without leave of court, and they're supposed to take control of the asset. This is an asset. It's a bank account. Should have taken control of it. That money wouldn't have been spent ridiculously out in casinos. So I have 53 seconds. If the judges have any further questions? Thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the arguments this morning. This matter will stand submitted. We are in recess, so the call of the court at 1:30.